I want you to picture a piece of steel. You know, just a standard gray, heavy block of metal. It feels solid, uniform, maybe a little cold.
It's the definition of inanimate, isn't it? Just a lump of matter.
Exactly. But what if I told you that inside that cold gray block, there is a landscape so complex, so violent, and so incredibly tiny that it has sparked an 80-year-long scientific civil war?
It does sound dramatic when you put it that way, but honestly, it's not an exaggeration. The violence at the atomic level is very real.
Today we are doing a deep dive into something that sounds like it was ripped straight out of a comic book. It's called Super Bainite.
Right. And it's a material that promises the strength of, say, incredibly expensive aerospace alloys, but at a fraction of the
It's
cost.
the holy grail of metallurgy in a lot of ways.
It is cheap ingredients, but you get this superhero performance.
But like any good superhero story, it has a fatal flaw, a hidden vulnerability. And to uncover that, we're looking at a really comprehensive piece of work.
A PhD thesis from the University of Cambridge by Lucy Chandra Devi Fielding.
The title is a bit of a mouthful.
Oh, it is. Understanding toughness and ductility in novel steels with mixed microstructures. But, you know, don't let that academic title fool you. This is essentially a detective story.
It really is. So let's start with the basics. We're talking about steel, but this isn't the kind of steel you'd find in a soup can or a paperclip.
No, not at all. We are talking about high-performance nanostructured steel. And I think the hook here for anyone listening is realizing that steel, like, this isn't just a solid block, it's a
A
composite.
composite, you mean like carbon fiber or something?
In a way, yes, conceptually, it's a mixture of different crystal structures all fighting for space inside the same solid object. Fielding's work focuses on superbainite, and this stuff can reach strengths of, what, 1600 megapascal?
Okay, for context, because I don't really speak Pascal, regular mild steel, like in a building frame, is what?
Oh, around 250, maybe 300
So
megapascal.
this is 5 or 6 times stronger.
Easily. It is incredibly robust.
But here's the catch, and this is the central problem of the thesis. Usually, when you make something that hard, it gets brittle, you know, like glass, hard. But if you drop it.
It shatters into a million pieces.
Right. And Fielding finds that while superbainite can hold a massive load, it struggles with toughness and ductility. So if you hit it sharply or try to stretch it, it might just snap.
Exactly. So her thesis is all about figuring out why the supermaterial has a glass jaw. And more importantly, can we fix it without losing the superpowers?
Understand the fix, we have to shrink ourselves down. We need to look at what this stuff is actually made of. So section one is simply, what on earth is superbainite? You said it's a mixed microstructure.
Right. Okay, so paint a picture in your head. Imagine a lasagna.
Okay, I'm hungry, but I'm with you. A lasagna.
A really, really microscopic lasagna. You've got these layers. The main pasta sheets are a phase called bainitic ferrite. That's the hard, strong part of the material.
Okay, so the pasta is the backbone.
Correct. And separating those plates are these thin films of something called retained austenite.
The sauce between the layers.
Exactly. But here's the super factor. We are not talking millimeters here.
Yeah.
These ferrite plates are roughly 20 to 40 nanometers thick.
Nanometers. So how does that compare to, say, a human hair?
A human hair is about 80,000 nanometers thick.
Wow. Okay.
So we are talking about structures thousands of times thinner than a single hair.
So why does making them so thin make the steel strong? Why does the size of the pasta sheet matter?
It's all about boundaries. In metals, when you bend or dent them, that happens because little glitches in the crystal, called dislocations, move around. If they can move easily, the metal is soft.
Okay, so we want to stop them from moving.
Right, and boundaries act like stop signs. The more boundaries you have, the harder it is for those glitches to travel. Because superbainite plates are so incredibly thin, the amount of surface area, the interface between the pasta and the sauce is massive.
It's just a maze of stop signs.
Precisely. The surface area is actually greater than what you'd get if you physically smashed a piece of metal to deform it. That's where the strength comes from. It's just geometric constriction.
But we still need that sauce, the austenite. Why keep it? Isn't austenite just the hot phase that's supposed to disappear when steel cools down?
Usually, yes. But here we want to keep some of it because austenite is ductile. It's the shock absorber. If a crack tries to run through the hard ferrite plates, it hits a film of austenite.
And the austenite just absorbs the hit.
Ideally, yeah. It deforms, it absorbs the energy, and it blunts the crack.
So it's a team. Ferri provides the muscle, austenite provides the flexibility.
That's the dream team. But Fielding points out the nightmare scenario. Sometimes you don't just get these nice thin films, you get blocky regions of austenite, big chunks.
The lasagna wasn't cooked evenly. You've got these raw bits of dough.
Sort of, and those blocks are unstable. If you put them under stress, instead of acting like a shock absorber, they suddenly snap into a completely different phase called martensite.
And martensite is bad.
Untempered martensite is very hard, but incredibly brittle. So imagine you're stressing the steel, relying on that austenite to save you, and suddenly, snap, it turns into brittle glass right when you need it most.
That is a betrayal at the atomic level.
It really is. It's a delicate balancing act. But before we get to how we manage this, we have to talk about the history here. Because you mentioned an 80-year war, and I think most people assume scientists are these quiet, polite people who just agree on everything.
I was honestly shocked by this. I didn't realize metallurgists were so combative.
Oh, science can get very heated. Fielding dedicates chapter 2 of her thesis to what's called the Bainite controversy.
Sounds like a soap opera.
As the steel turns.
It has the drama of one. For decades, the metallurgical world was split into two hostile camps over how Bainite actually forms.
Okay, who were the two sides?
On one side, you had the diffusional camp, researchers like Hillert and Aronson. They believed that for Bainite to form, the atoms have to wander around.
Yeah, they diffuse randomly across the boundary. It's like, if you want to turn a red brick house into a blue brick house, their theory is that you take it all apart, brick by brick, move the atoms across the street, and rebuild it from scratch.
So it's a reconstruction, slow, chaotic, random.
Right. But then you had the displacive or shear camp. This was championed by Harry Padecia, who was Fielding's supervisor, and earlier by legends like Coe and Cottrell.
And their theory was different.
Completely. They argued the atoms don't wander. They march. They move in a coordinated military formation. The whole crystal lattice shears.
So not brick by brick.
No. Imagine a deck of cards. If you push the top, the whole shape shifts, right? The cards don't change places with each other. They all slide together. That's a shear.
Chaos versus coordination.
Yes. And this isn't just, you know, academic trivia. The reason we have Super Bainite today is because one side won this war.
And that was the shear camp.
The shear camp. And Fielding's thesis presents some fascinating visual proof.
This is where the surface relief comes in, right?
Yeah, exactly. Back in the 50s, Coe and Cottrell showed that when bainite forms, it creates these little bumps on the surface of the steel. It actually changes the shape of the sample.
Help me with this. If the atoms were just wandering randomly, the shape wouldn't change.
Not really. Diffusion is messy. It doesn't really change the macroscopic shape. But a shear, that coordinated movement, physically pushes the material up, like a fault line in an earthquake.
And Fielding backs this up with modern tech.
She does. She highlights these images from an atomic race microscope, which basically feels the surface with a tiny needle, and they show the austenite right next to the growing bainite looks bruised.
Bruised? How do you bruise metal?
It's plastically deformed. The bainite grows so aggressively and so fast because of the shear that it actually dents the metal right next to it. It runs out of room.
That's wild. So the crystal grows until it just chokes itself off.
Yes. That's why bainite forms as these tiny little subunits, these sheaves, instead of one long plate. It bruises its neighbor and has to stop. It's a self-limiting violence.
There was another term that seemed to seal the deal here. The T-dollar curve. Yeah. Now, I'll be honest. My eyes glaze over a bit with equations. What is that in plain English?
Okay, think of a normal chemical reaction like a fire. It burns until it runs out of fuel. In the diffusional theory, the transformation should keep going until the austenite runs out of carbon.
Until the fuel is gone. Makes sense.
But with bainite, the reaction stops early. There's still plenty of carbon left in the austenite, but the growth just quits.
Why? Why is it quit?
Because of the T-dollar curve. It's a thermodynamic limit. Because the atoms are shearing, they trap a huge amount of strain energy in the lattice. The T-dollar curve is the point where that strain energy becomes too high to keep going. It hits an energy wall, not a fuel wall.
Okay, so the shear theory predicts this early stop. The diffusion theory can't explain it.
Exactly. And here's why this matters to you listening at home. Who cares if atoms march or wander? Well, if you believe they wander, you can't really predict how to make super bainite. It's just trial and error.
But if they march?
If they march, and you know the rules of the march, the thermodynamics, you can use those equations to design the alloy on a computer. Super bainite was invented because Padecia and his team at On the Shear Theory. The theory was the blueprint.
That is really cool. It's vindication through invention.
It is, but knowing the theory is one thing. Making it work in a factory is another. And that brings us to the need for speed.
Right. Section three, the industrial reality.
Right.
Because making this stuff sounds
slow.
Agonizingly slow. To get that perfect nanostructure, you had to heat treat the steel at really low temperatures, around 200, 300 degrees Celsius, for a very long time.
And how long are we talking?
I mean, depending on the alloy, days, sometimes weeks.
No factory wants to tie up a furnace for a week just for one batch of steel. That sounds expensive.
It's an economic nightmare. So Fielding investigates something called Alloy A. This was an attempt to speed up the reaction.
How do you hit the accelerator on a crystal transformation?
You tweak the recipe. In this case, they reduce the manganese. Manganese is an element that stabilizes austenite. It makes it sluggish and lazy. Takes them out, and the transformation kicks off much faster.
Okay, so less manganese, faster steel. Problem solved.
Well, there's no free lunch in material science. When you change the chemistry, you move that T-dollar curve we talked about, you change the thermodynamics. So Fielding had to figure out, if we rush this, do we still get the superstructure?
Or do we just get a mess?
Right. And this leads us to the mystery of the Charpie test. This is where Fielding really puts on her detective hat.
I love this part. First, remind us what a Charpie test is.
It's a standard engineering test. You take a bar of the steel about the size of a finger. You cut a little V-shaped notch in the middle. Then you swing a heavy pendulum at it.
Like a sledgehammer on a pivot.
Exactly. And you measure how much energy the bar absorbs before it snaps.
If it absorbs a lot, it's tough. If it absorbs very little.
It's brittle. And with this new, faster superbainite, Alloy A, something weird happened. It was failing in a brittle way, but specifically, it was brittle right at the notch.
Just at the V shape.
Yeah. The rest of the material seemed okay. So they looked at that notch root with x-rays to see what was going on with the crystals.
And what did they find?
Notch root embrittlement. Remember that unstable, blocky austenite we talked about earlier? The traitorous lasagna chunks?
The stuff that turns into brittle glass.
Exactly. It turns out that just the act of machining the notch, the physical process of cutting that V into the sample, put enough stress on the material to transform the austenite into brittle martensite right there at the tip.
Wait, so the test sample was broken because they made it into a test sample?
Essentially, yes. The damage from the cutting tool created a little zone of brittle martensite. As soon as the pendulum hit, that brittle zone cracked, and the crack just unzipped the rest of the sample.
That is incredible sensitivity. It's like a Heisenberg uncertainty principle for steel. The act of measuring it changes it.
It really highlights the double-edged sword of this mixed microstructure. You have this high-performance engine, but if you even look at it wrong, it breaks.
So we have physical stress causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
But the thesis also uncovers a chemical enemy, one that is arguably more insidious. Hydrogen?
Ah, yes. Hydrogen embrittlement. It is the silent assassin of high-strength steels.
And Fielding dedicates a whole chapter to this. She uses a concept that I usually associate with making coffee. Percolation.
Right. With coffee, you want it to percolate, to flow through.
Yeah.
But in steel, you want the exact opposite when it comes to hydrogen.
Walk me through this. How does hydrogen get in there, and why does percolation matter?
Well, hydrogen is tiny. It's the smallest element. It can slip in during manufacturing or just from moisture in the air. Once it's in, it wants to move. And it turns out hydrogen moves very slowly through those hard ferrite plates.
The pasta sheets are roadblocks.
Pretty much. But it can move pretty well through the austenite films. So think of the austenite as a road network inside the steel.
A highway system.
Exactly. And if those austenite films are all connected, if they percolate through the entire block, you have a continuous highway. Hydrogen can travel deep into the material, find a weak spot, and cause a delayed fracture.
It rots it from the inside out.
Effectively. But what if you cut the highway? If the austenite films are isolated, like little islands in a sea of ferrite, the hydrogen hits a dead end. It's trapped near the surface.
So the goal isn't just to have austenite, but to quarantine it.
Precisely. And this is a huge insight. Fielding used a technique called thermal desorption to figure this out. She basically heated up the steel to see how much hydrogen came out and how fast.
And she found the tipping point.
She found the percolation threshold. There is a specific volume fraction, a specific amount of austenite where the connectivity suddenly breaks. Below that number, the highways are cut. Above it, they're open.
That completely changes how you design the material. It's not just about how much austenite you have, but what shape it's in.
The morphology is king. It shifts the focus from just chemistry to geometry.
This thesis really covers the full spectrum of violence, doesn't it? We've smashed it, we've poisoned it, and in Chapter 8, we shoot it.
Ballistics, when armor fails.
This section was fascinating. They took a coarser version of this armor and fired projectiles at it. And the way it failed wasn't just cracking. It was something called adiabatic shear bands.
It's a mouthful, but it connects back to that shear theory. Adiabatic is a physics term that just means without losing heat.
So the heat stays trapped.
Right. When a bullet hits armor, it all happens so fast in microseconds that the energy has nowhere to go. It stays right there. The steel shears, and that friction generates this intense, localized heat.
How hot are we talking?
Hundreds of degrees, maybe over 1,000, in a tiny sliver of metal. In most steels, that heat would cause a phase change. The steel would get so hot it would transform.
That's what I would expect. But Fielding found a twist.
She did. Despite the intense heat in these shear bands, the material, it didn't change phase, it didn't transform, it stayed as bainitic ferrite.
Wait, so it got hot enough to change, but it just...
It refused. The lattice was twisted and smeared to an extreme degree. It failed mechanically, but the crystal structure itself stayed stubborn.
Why is that a surprise?
Because it challenges the assumption that heat alone drives the failure. It suggests the failure is pure deformation, not a phase change. The bainite is incredibly stable, maybe too stable in this case.
But if we want better armor, we have to design the microstructure to resist that specific kind of sliding, shearing failure.
Exactly. It's another clue for the designers. Complicates things, but it also gives us a target.
We have covered a massive amount of ground here. Let's try to pull this all together. We started with the 80-year war.
The diffusional versus displacive debate. The foundational theory that atoms march in formation.
And we saw how that shear theory was used as a blueprint to design superbainite.
Right. Ferrite plates for strength, austenite films for toughness.
But then we ran into the real-world villains. Unstable, blocky austenite that shatters when you machine it, and these connected highways that let hydrogen sneak in.
And the economic pressure to make it faster, which risks messing up the whole recipe.
It really feels like we are on the edge of a breakthrough, but it's precarious. Is superbainite the future, or is it just too finicky to ever be mainstream?
It's a classic case of material science being a game of compromise. There is no unobtainium. If you want strength, you often sacrifice ductility. If you want speed, you sacrifice stability.
But Fielding's work seems to offer a map through that minefield.
It does. It stops us from flying blind. It tells us, yes, you can have this amazing strength, but here are the specific geometric rules you have to follow.
It's about control.
Absolute control. Not just of the chemistry, but of the geometry of those microscopic films.
And that leads me to a final thought. Fielding's work shows that the limit of this steel isn't really the strength of the iron atoms themselves. It's the stability of that retained austenite.
Right. The weak link is the geometry of the soft parts.
So, if we could perfectly control that geometry, say, in the future, if we could print the microstructure atom by atom to ensure every piece of austenite is a perfectly stable, isolated island.
If you could do that, if you could completely isolate the vulnerability while keeping the benefit.
Could we effectively create a steel that is unbreakable?
That is the holy grail, theoretically. The ceiling for performance is much, much higher than where we are now.
Oh, yeah.
We just have to figure out how to build the Lidvanya perfectly every single time.
A fascinating possibility to leave you with. That's it for this deep dive into the microscopic world of superbainite. Thanks for listening.
A pleasure.